Welcome to the Repro 360 podcast, proudly sponsored by Vetoquinol Australia. Our mission is to inspire, educate, and at times entertain you as we delve into the fascinating world of making better bovine babies. I'm Rebecca Arnott, and I recently had the pleasure of speaking with Associate Professor Dr. Kai Pawler during the 2024 Genetics Australia Today, Tomorrow and Beyond conference. As one of America's leading experts in bovine reproductive physiology, Kai shared his thoughts with me on the US market, global repro trends, especially around IVF, as well as his insights into work he's done on the costly area of pregnancy losses. Kai, welcome to Australia and the Making Better Bovine Babies podcast. You very kindly agreed to do this podcast in between sessions at the Genetics Australia conference here. So let's get straight into it.
Yeah, no, thanks. Thanks for having me. And it's really great to be here in Australia and to be visiting about bovine reproduction.
I don't think you've been here even a week yet, but what have been your impressions about Australia and our cattle industry so far?
Yeah, so I think that if you look at the overall industry and what I've been able to visit since I've been here the last 8 days, is that, you know, there's a ton of opportunity and opportunities to increase efficiency. And I think that, you know, on a few things that have really sort of piqued my interest is that you're seeing, you know, more adoption of reproductive technologies into both the beef and the dairy space. And so in the beef space, you know, seeing people that are, you know, using more AI or starting to think about using ET or even IVF based embryos. And in the dairy space, really starting to, a lot of people focused on beef on dairy, which has obviously been a hot topic at this conference, and thinking about how you sort of implement that into a program. So yeah, a lot of opportunities. I think that, you know, in a lot of sense, there's a lot of similar kind of mentality in cattle between the two countries as we compare those, and kind of looking at what works well and what doesn't work well, and then how do you maximize efficiency within you guys' environment.
And we'll talk a bit more about that later. You're one of the leading bovine reproductive experts in the US, so I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to talk to you about your current work around pregnancy losses, assisted reproduction trends in the US, and also try and ascertain the extent to which we're likely to follow in your footsteps. So if we start with the bigger picture, there appears to be an enormous chasm between what's happening over there and what's happening here, particularly in terms of IVF. What are your thoughts around that?
Yeah, so IVF is an interesting trend to follow. Let's go back 15 years and kind of look at the evolution. So 15 years ago, you would see a ton of IVF utilized in the South American market, specifically in Brazil, where it was really heavily used, really large companies that developed sort of what I would call large-scale commercial applications of in vitro fertilization. And over the last 15 years, we've seen that sort of adopted into the U.S., maybe from a little bit different model point of view, where we're not talking on maybe a per-pregnancy basis, but on a per-embryo basis. And I've seen a number of large companies, private labs, all in between, be generated around the U.S. and really change going from multiple ovulation embryo transfer to where now that only makes up a small proportion of our market compared to how much IVF is made up. And I think, you know, as I kind of look at what's happening here in Australia, it seems like where the U.S. was maybe 10 years ago, where there's people starting to use IVF and sort of starting to knock that barrier down. But you still see these really high differences maybe in fertility and pregnancy rates coming from the two technologies here on the ground. And so I think sort of balancing that, and I think it's part of a situation where really no matter where you are in the world, once you introduce a technology, there's some growing pains to it until you get it up and running, and then sort of tailoring it to fit what the needs of the producers here are.
So I understand in the US around 80% of embryos are produced from IVP, whereas yeah, we're still sitting at probably 85, if not 95% plus from MOET. What have been the main drivers of growth in the US and or the main benefits of IVP?
Yeah, so you know, the one biggest that probably initially started it was the number of people that knew how to do multiple ovulation embryo transfer and flushing, and then the younger generation of veterinarians that don't know how to do it and that really aren't trained to do it. So that's one driver. So trained individuals. So you've seen a lot more people gravitate toward ovum pickup because, you know, you can take a cow, drop her off at a center, take her for a haul and just have it done and then go back and pick her up. And the other change in that is that it's easier to do, so it doesn't require the number of injections. In some cases, there was unstimulated cows collected, which I think we're going to talk a little bit about. It allowed for animals that didn't react well to multiple ovulation embryo transfer to be used in IVF. But I think that one thing that also helped was it allowed for using pregnant donors to keep them in the same production cycle and to be able to do ovum pickup and IVF from them.
Would you say the uptake of IVP in the US has been driven by the dairy industry?
Yeah, that's an interesting question I really haven't thought about. It's been twofold. I mean, there's been a lot of influence in the dairy industry, but where I'm located in Texas, there is a lot of beef cows, especially seed stock producers that would be using IVF. So I think it's a little bit of both. There's obviously been a lot of IVF embryos made in dairies, but there's also a lot being used in beef operations as well.
How many embryos would you say are produced in the US each year, and what proportion would be used or transferred, stored, or even exported?
Yeah, that's a good question. I can't even remember what the IATS numbers were for the last year now for what was produced in the US. But I do know that there's a lot more embryos that end up being stored than end up being transferred. I think that's true really wherever you go around the world. And I think, the freezing of IVF embryos continues to evolve, and so there was really a demand early on to use a lot of fresh, and I think a lot of people were freezing their extras or holding on to them, and so always there's going to be more embryos that are stored and not transferred versus the ones that this proportion that ends up being used. So,
which beef breeds would you say have had the highest uptake of IVP and why?
Yeah, so Angus would definitely be one. Brangus, Brahmins, a lot of the Bosinicus breeds that have had a lot of work done in them. I think as you look at kind of the way you look at it is in breeds that have very high semen value, you're going to see a lot of IVF because you can take one straw of semen and make a lot of calves out of it, right? So, for example, on a Brahmin bull that have a $10,000 straw of semen or even more, can make a lot of calves that way. Mata Angus, and I think that's an important point because the labs have really developed protocols that are specific to those two subspecies independently to be able to work in both, right? So if we would think where IVF was in the beef industry in Brazil 15 years ago, that was very focused toward Bosinicus-related females versus in the U.S. and here in Australia where there'd be a mix of both Bostaris and Bosinicus.
Let's talk about results and then have a bit of a deeper dive into the many variables that can impact the outcome. Do you have any benchmark figures we can start with for those considering MOET or IVP?
Yep. So, I mean, I think the really important thing is to think about what are the realistic expectations to a producer when you're considering this, because it is a relatively large investment compared to something like AI. So from a MOET point of view, fresh embryos from MOET, we would get anywhere from 60 to 70% pregnancy rates, okay? From frozen conventional MOET embryos, you might decrease that by 5-7%. By the time we get into fresh IVP-based embryos, we're going to be somewhere around 50-55%. And then, unfortunately, by the time we get into frozen IVFs, kind of the average that we're looking at now is somewhere between 35-40%. And so, a lot of people, I think, might be critical of those numbers that I give, but those are the averages. So in every average, you have farms that are going to be a lot better, and you have farms that are going to be a lot worse than that. And I kind of like to think about the averages because when I go to a producer and talk to them about whether they're going to use the technology or not, I think they need to have a realistic expectation of what they're going to get, not what is the highest that you could potentially get in the situation.
And do you see much variation between breeds, like Bosindicus to Bostaurus, beef first dairy?
Yeah, so big differences in the number of oocytes they'll give from an ovum pickup. So your Bosindicus breeds tend to give more oocytes compared to our Bostaurus breeds. From a variation in pregnancy, I would say not so much. I mean, I can definitely think about donors off the top of my mind right now in all breeds that have very good results and then donors that have very bad results. a few months ago, I gave a talk at an embryo transfer meeting, and I said that, you know, we've been doing IVF now for 30, 40 years, and we still have pregnancy rates that are 0% from specific donors, and from specific matings, we still have 100%. So the variation hasn't changed, but we've gotten better at the averages.
Just going back to the fresh versus frozen, what proportion of embryos in the US would be transferred fresh?
It ultimately depends on how close they would be to the lab that they're working with. So I think it's probably about 50-50 if I had to put a number on it. We would ultimately like to transfer as many fresh as we can, but ultimately get in a situation from logistics that, you know, if we're trying to send a package with embryos in it, fresh embryos in an incubator, and, you know, you're trying to send it in the upper Midwest, you get a snowstorm, and the package gets lost, the embryos are gone, right? So there's situations like that that happen all the time, so I think it's kind of balancing that risk versus reward. Can I drive them? Can I fly them? All those different aspects. And ultimately, the logistics part of the ET business is just as critical as making good embryos to make sure that you get things to the lab on time. And I think that will be a big aspect of, as the IVF businesses are worked out here in Australia, as to how that happens and how that works.
And do you think science and technology is moving so that, to an extent, that the gap between fresh and frozen is narrowing?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen promising results here in the last 6 months that would suggest that that is the case. I would say what we can't take is we can't take the 10s, the 15%. If we know that we're going to transfer a frozen product and on average we're going to get 40% and I'm going to get that over and over again, then a producer can manage that. It's when you get some that are 10, you get some that are 40, some that are 25. That's where the struggle comes in, and how do you manage that amount of difference between them?
Data from IETS suggests nearly all IVP embryos in Europe are produced with follicle-stimulating hormone, and I believe the majority in the US are too. Is this correct? And if so, is it because producers are focused on results rather than the convenience?
Let me say it this way. There are labs that recommend the use of FSH, and there's labs that don't recommend the use of FSH. If you look at the data that is out there in the published literature, it would suggest that using follicle-stimulating hormone, a lower dose, not what we would use in a MOET, but a lower dose, will be beneficial to oocyte quality and embryo quality and embryo survival from a round of IVP. And I think that I'm a firm believer in that. I think that we make better embryos when follicle-stimulating hormone is used as part of that program. You know, I think there's always the odd-off one that, you know, oh, at the last minute I decided to collect this donor so she didn't get, you know, one, two, or three shots of FSH prior to that. And that's okay. I think that's perfectly fine. But for the majority of our donors, we should be trying to do that to maximize the efficiency at which we're going to produce embryos. Because ultimately, especially here in Australia and even in the U.S., OPU IVF ends up costing more per embryo than MOET does. And so if I'm going to make that huge investment, why would I not invest the one, two, or three more injections just to make sure that I have the highest quality product ready to go into the IVF system?
And could you tell me about the cost benefit, if there is one, of using FSH in Bos indicus cattle?
Yeah, so the same story is true there. I mean, Bos indicus got labeled as a situation that they didn't have to use FSH because of what had previously been done in South America with Bos indicus, specifically in the Loray. And one thing that's important to point out is that if you take Brahman and Nelore, for example, Brahman's a very different Bos indicus breed than Nelore is. So those animals react totally different, and what happens in a Nelore does not happen in a Brahman or vice versa. And so it ultimately comes down to the exact same situation. Yes, I'm going to get a lot of oocytes from a Brahman or a Brangus type cow when I collect her, but if I want those oocytes to be of the highest quality and be prepared for fertilization, the best way to do that is through using FSH. It's a very, especially because you're talking about a lot more oocytes, so theoretically a lot more embryos. If you start to calculate on a per embryo basis for cost, you got a lot of money tied up there. So let's say a round is going to end up costing $3,000, $4,000. What's an extra $100, $200 in the big scheme of things.
Wagyus don't tend to respond as well to IVP, do they? And do you know why that is?
Yeah, that's a, you know, it's been a, we obviously have a large influx of Wagyus into the U.S. market and Akushi genetics as well. And there's even differences between Wagyu and Akushi as you compare them to each other as how they respond. You know, I looked at some data recently. I think there's Wagyus that definitely respond, that do well, and there's some that don't do, on average, they don't do that well as a breed. And, you know, they're different animals. I mean, they, if you just think about their meat characteristics is the main reason we're breeding them, right? They have very different, big differences in that. And so there's most likely some differences in the overall physiology of those animals and their ability to be able to respond to the OPU-IVF protocols. I do know a number of people that have been rather successful using Moen on them to, you know, by figuring out different doses of FSH to give them to be able to produce Moen embryos, which tells me that we probably need a little bit more tweaking on the IVF side and we'll be eventually able to get that.
Media also has a big impact on the result of an IVP program and probably Moet too. Could you comment on that?
There's so many medias sold on the market and produced privately within each of the companies. And, you know, I think we're also learning what an embryo needs in the first 7 days of life more and more and more. We also know that there's some medias with specific growth promotants, things like serum, promote large offspring and large calves. We have seen a drastic reduction of that in the U.S. market, and I think really around the world of, you know, taking those type of products out to make sure that we're not harming cows or not having these really large calves. But ultimately, you know, that's the competitive advantage that each company might have against each other as they kind of determine who's better at making embryos versus not, as it really comes down to the media. There's certain things that are probably identical across every company's media, some salts or some additions, etc. But the finite details would be different, and that's really, I think, where you might see some of these aspects that affect pregnancy or pregnancy loss coming from.
And do all media need the FSH, do they, to grow?
Yeah, so
initial maturation media?
Yeah, so initial maturation media, so you basically have maturation media, fertilization media, and culture media. So the initial maturation media would have some form of FSH addition into it in order for the final maturation of the oocytes. And so, you know, again, it'll be a little bit different as to how much in each of the group's medias that they're using.
I believe females can be aspirated from, is it as young as 2 months or 4 months?
Yeah, so 3 to 4 months. We've seen some aspirations done. Those would be done laparoscopically, not transvaginally, like we'd have in a mature animal. And yeah, so theoretically, a 3-month-old heifer calf could have embryos. By the time that she might have her first calf, she would have offspring on the ground, if you think about it that way. So pretty remarkable situation.
I'd say the uptake of IVP here is still very much limited by a number of factors, including cost, the limited number of labs, the distance to labs, lack of OPU technicians we've touched on, and we've touched a little bit on the embryo quality or results. Was this the case in the US when you started, and how have these challenges been overcome?
It's easy to think about sort of the shininess of IVF, IVP, etc. But from a business and entrepreneurial point of view, you have to look at it, okay, what's the viable business model here in Australia to develop labs and to build labs and to use IVF? So this is not unlike any other sort of market that has transitioned into IVF. And I think the thing that, you know, has to be looked at is what's the cost going to be? Right? What can I get my cost down to? So if I have a lab that, you know, would service a 500-kilometer radius, is my cost low enough in that area to service that big of area? Or do I need to have a bigger area? Or do I need to have a smaller area? You know, what do those situations look like from logistics? How quick can I get to the farm? How quick can I get back? How can I get fresh embryos out? Who's going to be the transfer technicians? Because if you got OPU technicians, you're going to need transfer technicians. And if you're really busy, those can't be the same people. You got to think about timing of fertilization. So if I have a lab that, you know, oocytes arrive and fertilization needs to be done at 3 or 4 in the morning. Is there a workforce that's going to be able to handle that when we have fertilizations all day? So all those aspects have to be taken into account, I think, as you think about sort of the viability of a business model and how they're set up. And then one thing, the other aspect that's important is that we have to think about, is the opportunity to use reverse sex sorted semen going to be part of it? So do you need access to a sorter? And then, you know, how much access are you going to have to that sorter? That puts another logistical aspect into each of those. And if you think about potentially a seasonality to it as well, so, you know, Australia has a lot of seasonal-based calving operations, and if we think about a beef operation, that would be that way. You can't just shut the lab down and not have anything to do and continue to maintain cash flow. So those are all considerations that I think have to be kind of thought about and mapped out. And it's IVF and it's technology, but I still think at the end of the day, it's a very big logistical business that has to be developed to put it all in place.
We heard yesterday, Mo, it's likely to remain the gold standard here for some time yet, and that, you know, your explanations probably explain why. And we also heard yesterday it costs around $100 for a Moet embryo versus $300 for an IVP one. Or if we take that to a cost per pregnancy rate, we're talking maybe $300 to $500 for Moet, or a very significant $800 to maybe $1,500 per pregnancy for an IVP embryo, with all the associated costs. How does that compare with the US prices?
Let me say it this way. If you give me a donor that's very efficient in Moet, it's going to be a lot cheaper to get pregnancies out of her than one that's not efficient at Moet. Same thing is true at IVF. So if I get a donor that's really efficient in making IVF embryos and making pregnancies, then I'm going to be way better off than one that's not. So my whole point is that you can efficiently do it in both systems if you have donors that are performing at a very high level and producing pregnancies. Ultimately, it doesn't matter if you make a million embryos. If you don't have good pregnancy rates and low pregnancy loss, they're both inefficient. And I think we have examples in both systems where that would be the case. The closing of the gap will be critical to help sort of, and that's going to happen from volume, labor, all those aspects that come into play that will help sort of close that gap between the two technologies. But ultimately, at the end of the day, the cost per pregnancy should not be a whole lot different if your donors are producing at a high level once you get there. It's getting to that point and sort of having early adopters that help get that volume up and the cost down to make that happen. So, I mean, I think if I'd have told a dairy farmer or a beef producer, you know, 25 years ago that you would buy a straw of sex semen for $75 to $100, they would tell you you're crazy. And yet they do it every day now. And so I think it's a very similar idea to this aspect.
Well, you've just finished giving a very interesting talk on pregnancy losses in cattle. And you posed the question, whose fault is it, the cows or the bulls? And you reminded us that a cow that loses a pregnancy is a lot more expensive than a cow that doesn't get pregnant. Would you mind just sharing some of the key findings of the talk you gave and your take-home messages?
If you ask somebody what's fertility, you ask a room of people what's fertility, you'll get a bunch of different answers. And so fertility for me is that you have to take a cow or a heifer, inseminate her or transfer an embryo into her, establish a pregnancy, maintain that pregnancy, and get a live calf on the ground. And we know that there's a lot of inefficiencies in the system all the way across that. And so some of the things that we've noticed that have big impacts on that would be things like estrus expression. You know, how strong of estrus expression or estrus intensity does the cow have prior to AI or prior to embryo transfer? We know that there's bulls that have big differences in fertility because of either having high or low pregnancy loss between one or two preg checks. And so I think that as we, in the other point that I made in my talk was, pregnancy loss isn't getting higher in our herds. I don't think we all of a sudden woke up one day and pregnancy loss is 12% in our herds. I think we're doing a really good job of measuring it and tracking it now. And if you measure and you track something, you have an opportunity to change it. If we don't measure it and we don't track it, then we don't have that opportunity to change it. And so I think in this situation, we have an opportunity to change it. We have an opportunity to manage it. And those cows that lose a pregnancy obviously do cost us a lot of money. So what can we do? Select cows that have higher estrus expression for breeding to higher value semen or getting an embryo. We can select bulls that have higher fertility, both at initial preg check and a final preg check. Overall management of our cow herds are important. Repro is this really funny thing that costs less than 1 to 2% of our overall farm budget, but has a huge financial impact on the farm. We try to save repro with this magic bullet, and it just doesn't work. It's a nice idea, and we can overcome a lot of things with protocols and high fertility bulls, etc. But ultimately, you have to have other management tracking with that to get good fertility.
Kai, we both want to listen to this next talk on IVF, so I'm going to finish with one question. With your expertise and your crystal ball, what significant changes do you think we'll see realized in the industry, say, in the next 10 years?
So I think that IVF will definitely become very, very commonplace. And I think that we will see genetic packages sold in different ways. I don't think semen will ever go away, but I think that we'll see a lot more embryos transacted as we move forward. And it will be common to, you know, have a tank full of embryos that, you know, companies would sell and move genetics on. I honestly think that gene editing will have a big impact on the future of agriculture and specifically the, you know, bovine industry as we move forward around the world. I think specifically related to health traits, to traits that are not production focused, that are more animal health and animal comfort based driven traits. And I think that, you know, agriculture as a whole, we have to continue to make sure our story is told. We have to make sure that we are in a good public standing with the consumer and the public. But I think we shouldn't be afraid to educate our friends and educate our peers and to talk to them about agriculture. You know, I feel fortunate that, you know, I grew up on a farm and now I get to sort of kind of go around the world and work in agriculture. But, you know, as simple as just talking to somebody on an airplane and talking to them about what agriculture is and where their food comes from. And ultimately, I think that's what it's going to take as we take this next hurdle, this sustainable approach to agriculture. And one thing that I forgot to say in my talk, but I'll say it here on the podcast, sustainability. Okay, so what does sustainability mean? I'm not exactly sure what it means, but I do know that if animals don't reproduce, you can't be sustainable. We can develop whatever metrics we want for sustainability, and we can be the most carbon neutral and environmental friendly animals ever. But if they don't reproduce, that has a big impact. So we have to be careful as we sort of move into the sustainability model to make sure that we have a very high fertility animal to maintain that big financial part of what that 1 or 2% brings to the table.
Kai, it's been so interesting talking to you and an absolute pleasure. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
If you're enjoying our podcast or learning something new, please give us a review and share it as you see fit. And lastly, don't forget to follow our Repro 360 YouTube channel for some helpful repro tips, how-to videos, and webinars.